We really don't speak of the Psalms as chapters, but it's a psalm in which every single verse, with only maybe two or three exceptions, has some reference to God's law. It doesn't always use the term law. Sometimes it uses the term precept or instruction or commandment or ordinance or some other synonym for the law of God. But I want to call your attention especially to the 45th verse. It says, "And I will walk in liberty, for I seek thy precepts." Now the psalmist says that he is going to walk in liberty. He's going to find freedom because he seeks the precepts. That is, he looks out for and he keeps the laws of God. Now, this puts together two things, two ideas that we ordinarily think of as separate. We think of law as a restraining force that keeps us from being free. On the other hand, freedom is when you operate without anything to restrain you, without any law to hold you in. So I think to most people, at least on the surface, these two ideas of liberty and law are almost opposites of each other. But I suggest that this attitude, that liberty and law are somehow opposed to each other, results really from a misuse and abuse of liberty, and a misuse and abuse of law as well. In fact, I would argue that the real purpose of any good law, whether it's some earthly law that people make here in civil government and so on, or laws that parents may make for their children, or, more importantly, the laws that God has revealed for us in His Word, the real purpose of any and all good law is to set us free. And the two are not contradictory to each other, even though we often think of it that way. I know when you're a little kid and you're growing up and your parents lay down the law for you, you don't think of law as something that sets you free. But I would suggest even there, the real purpose for parents laying down the law for their children is to set their children free. And I'll try and illustrate that in just a moment. But I appeal to the scriptural passage. David says to us, or the author of the 119th Psalm, whoever it is, says to us, "I will walk in liberty, for I seek thy precepts." He had found out what the real purpose of God's law was. He had found out that by looking after, studying, and following God's law, that's where he found real and true freedom. Think about a song that we sing. Many people say it ought to be our national anthem. The song, "America the Beautiful." Do you remember how the last line of that song ends? "Confirm thy soul with self-control, thy liberty with law." Now, I realize that's not scripture, but I'm just saying that other people have found out the same thing that the psalmist has found out, that in order to have true freedom, you've got to have some laws. Confirm your soul with self-control. How do you keep your soul strong? Well, you have to exercise a certain amount of restraint on your soul. You have to have some, you might say, some internal laws. And then thy liberty, confirm thy liberty with law. Think what this country would be like if we had no laws whatsoever. Suppose we said, this is going to be the land of the free and the home of the brave. And by the land of the free, what we mean is nobody can make any laws. Of course, we've already made a law right there that nobody can make any laws. But suppose somebody says, that's going to be our only law, that nobody can make any laws. Think how free do you think this country would be? I'll tell you, it would be free for one person, whoever was the strongest and the meanest. It would be free for him. For the rest of us, it wouldn't be a free country. We'd be under his thumb. We'd have the so-called law of the jungle would pretty soon take everything over. We've discovered that to have a certain amount of freedom, we've got to have a certain amount of law. And the purpose of those laws, purpose of our Constitution, which is a law, is to give us freedom. The purpose of our Bill of Rights, which are all laws, are to give us freedom. You can't have freedom without being under some sort of law. illustrate that just on a very limited basis. I gave maybe too big a picture saying imagine this country without laws. Suppose we didn't have any traffic laws. We just built roads, you know. This morning, coming out here to church, I was driving out and came past the road that turned off to go down to Noreen's, and there was some mad bicycle driver comes flying down the road there, didn't stop at the stop sign or anything, whirled out and didn't come down the lane that he's supposed to get over into and come with the traffic. He turned right straight in the car where we were going. We all panicked. It wasn't quite that bad. But anyway, the point was he was going in total disregard of the law, and suddenly there was very little freedom. Everybody was thinking very quickly, how can we avoid somebody being killed right here? Why do we have traffic laws? You know, if we didn't have traffic laws, everybody would be terrified to step out onto the road. I mean, just stark raving terror. Some people are right now. But if we didn't have traffic laws, it'd be worse. But what happens? I mean, did you ever think about this? Now, don't keep talking to everybody about it on the way home today. But do you realize how much you depend on those laws? You're just driving down the road every day. I think about this sometimes when I'm of a particularly perverse frame of mind. And you're going down some two-lane highway, and there are all these cars going up and down Knights Griffith Road. You know, and all these cars in that other lane. And they're flying by you, and you're going 50 miles an hour, and they're coming 50 miles an hour the other way. And not anything but that little yellow line that separates you. And all of one of them would have to do would be, for some bizarre reason, to flip over, and, you know, there's nobody in the world have fast enough reflexes to be able to dodge it. I say the only thing that keeps you from them is that little yellow, that little white or yellow, whatever color line it is. It's really not that that keeps them from you, is it? It's the fact that you're counting on them keeping the law. You're counting on their common acceptance of the law that you're following. Because both of you realize that only if you keep that law are you free to go up and down that road without being absolutely terrified. Now, we could find a lot of other illustrations. I want to give one that I think I've probably given before, of laws that parents make for their children. And I would suggest that children keep this in mind. Those of you that are younger, those of you that are parents are going to say amen right now, but those of you that are younger, think about this, and we'll talk about the parents later. But you know, children tend to feel that their parents make laws because they want to get the children out of the way or something. They are somehow, and maybe sometimes parents do make laws for the wrong reason. Maybe sometimes they do give rules for their children for the wrong reason, just to satisfy some personal interest of the parent or something of that nature. But godly parents that are trying to do the right thing for their children, I want to tell you something. When they make laws for you, they've made those rules to set you free. Even though you may not feel that way, you say, oh, you're not letting me do this. That's right, they're not. Let me give an illustration. And once again, suppose backyard, that's one of the first rules that children become conscious of, you know, how far they can go in the yard, you know. And mom says, you can't go out in the street. The kid says, why can't I go out in the street? You know, well, if the little kid had any sense at all, he'd be terrified, but he's not old enough to be afraid to go out there. But suppose in your backyard, you know, you've got somehow a backyard that is surrounded on all three sides by danger. House that I first remember as a little kid, we had a railroad track came through the backyard. Big old steam engines, you know, those big old high-wheeler steam engines that you used to see, still see in the movies every once in a while. Those things would come puffing right through our backyard. And suppose you got one of those across the backside of your backyard, and on another side there's a lake or something deep enough to drown in back there. And then on the third side, maybe there's just a regular road that goes down that side. Now, you put a little child out there in the backyard, and if the child was old enough and mature enough to be aware of the danger that was around him on every side, he wouldn't be able to play in that yard. You know what he'd do? He'd just get right in the middle, And he'd be afraid to do anything. Because he'd say to himself, well, if I start chasing my ball and I forget, I may go over there and get hit by the train, or I may fall into the pond and drown, or run out into the road. And all I can do is just be here, right here in the middle, and be really careful that I concentrate on not doing anything so that I'll get out there. Now, little kid's not mature enough to be aware of that. So the parent has to step in. What does a parent do? Well, a parent probably, if he doesn't move, builds a fence around his yard. And that's a law. That's a restraint. In this case, he's probably not doesn't do enough good just to tell him you can't go play in the railroad tracks. He puts up a fence. He puts up a restraining device that more or less imposes that restraint or that law on the little child. And so there he is. He's got him a fence now that keeps him at a good safe distance from the lake and from the road and from the railroad tracks. Now what can the kid do? Why, he can run around and play to his heart's content. Because there is that restraint that keeps him from getting into danger. He can go chasing his ball and the parents don't worry about it because now they know that if he throws it too far and he starts running after it, before he gets into real danger, he's going to hit that restraining fence, and that's going to keep him from getting out into the railroad tracks or whatever. And so the parent, by putting up that restraining law, really makes it possible for the child to truly enjoy playing in the backyard. Now, we could give a lot of other illustrations of the same thing. But again, I suggest, young people, that you think about the laws that your parents are giving you and realize that really the reasons they're giving you these laws are because there are dangers out there that they are very much aware of, that you may not really recognize just how dangerous they are. And your parents want you to be able to enjoy your life as a young person. And they know you're not going to enjoy it if you get tripped up in some of these really bad, dangerous things that are out there. And so they give you laws. They give you laws about what time you're going to be in at night and who you can play with and where you can go, because they know the dangers. They put up those fences that'll make it happy, make it possible for you to be happy and really enjoy what you do inside the laws that they give you. But I want to illustrate this another way. I want to illustrate this with something that applies more to adults and those that are rapidly moving into that age bracket. I haven't said anything about marriage for some time in lessons, but quite a number of you are very rapidly approaching the age of marriage, even as we were riding out church this morning. Started discussing all the couples that had gotten engaged at school this year. And there'll be more, if not this spring, in another spring. And it's appropriate, I think, for me to take a minute to say something about God's law on marriage. Because there's another place where God has put up a fence. A very strong law that people in our society have rejected almost altogether. Let me tell you what God's law on marriage is. Because some people say, well, that's just, I can't believe that God would make such a strict law as this. I want you to look at some passages of Scripture with me. Turn to Matthew chapter 5. This is from the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, everyone always reads the Beatitudes there at the beginning. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted, and so on. But I'm afraid a lot of preachers today never make it down to some of the other things that Jesus says in this Sermon on the Mount. If you will, come down to verse 31 and read with me verses 31 and 32. Jesus says, "And it was said," says people used to say, "whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce." Apparently the idea was, well, if you're going to divorce her, at least make it legal. Verse 32, he says, "But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." And then turn over to Matthew chapter 19, where he says the same thing in a little bit larger context. Matthew chapter 19, verse 3. It says, some Pharisees came to him, testing him, saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. And then they raised question. I said, well, Moses, in the law of Moses, Old Testament, they said, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? And he said to them, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, he said, it has not been this way. And then look at verse 9. He says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. And the word immorality right there is not just for some very, very broad concept of immorality. It's specifically a word for sexual immorality. And it's often translated fornication. Now, God's law really is in many ways very simple. I realize there are all kinds of complications that sometimes arise in the application of it. But the basic law is remarkably simple. God said there is no acceptable basis for divorce except one. And that is what we usually call marital infidelity. I have the word chastity back there in chapter 5 and verse 32. And we have the word immorality or fornication here in chapter 19 and verse 9. Those terms all refer to marital infidelity. And he says that's the only basis. Nowadays, when you say that, people that have not heard that before are, for the most part, just absolutely appalled that anybody would have such a primitive notion. And they say, That must be disastrous. Think of how terrible it is for people to be married and then find out that they're not in love with each other and then they can't separate. That'd be horrible. Think of all the ruined lives if you tried to apply such a law as that. Well, now think about that. Do you think God gave us that law to ruin people's lives? You think that's why God did that? You think that's why he made it so strict? He said, I'm going to make those people as miserable as they can. I'm going to teach them to get married. I'm going to make it so that most of them are going to end up absolutely miserable. Do you think that's why God made that law? I mean, ultimately, are we not impugning God's motives and God's wisdom and his judgment and his character? In effect, saying he's not really God, if we say that. I think we ought to reflect for a little while and say, maybe God had a reason for making the law that way. And I think he did. What possible advantage could come from making the law so strict? I'm going to suggest two or three things. One is, first of all, people will be a whole lot more careful about getting married to start with. If you realize that the choice that you make is a choice that you're going to live with the rest of your life, then people would be far more careful than somebody says, well, let's get married, and if it doesn't work out, we can always separate. But even more important, perhaps, than the attitude of realizing before one is married, it's what happens after one is married. I want to tell you, people think this is such a restrictive law. And people talk about how much better off we are now that divorce is so readily available. I want to say, where in the world is the evidence? What in the world are you talking about? Any psychologist, any social scientist, any family counselor will tell you that there is no more traumatic experience that a person ever goes through than a divorce. It is far easier to suffer the death of your spouse than to endure a divorce, just in terms of the emotional trauma that one goes through. It is far easier for children to suffer the death of a parent than the divorce of their parents. Oh, there might be an exception here or there. But in general, I think almost anybody that is involved with that type of counseling and study will tell you very quickly that that's the case. And we live in a society where the family is disintegrating all around us. And everybody, like they've got their head stuck in their sand, pretends they can't understand why it's so. Like the almost complete abolition of God's standard about marriage had nothing to do with it. A 100 years ago, it was a shame to be divorced. I realize it shouldn't be a shame for somebody to be divorced if they're divorced for a scriptural reason. If their spouse was unfaithful to them and they were divorced for that reason, that shouldn't be a shame for them. But, as I say, 100 years ago, people were still sufficiently influenced by the Bible and by the teaching of biblical principles that they just didn't divorce. And as a result, most people grew up in stable families. There may have been other problems, but most people grew up in stable families. Nowadays, any school teacher can start telling you how few children he or she has in their classes come from stable families. And they can also tell you the difference between the children that do come from stable families and those that come from divorced families, by and large. The ones that are emotionally secure and generally tend to do fairly well in school. And the ones, on the other hand, that are emotionally insecure and often unable to cope with the things that are going on around them. And somebody says, why is this so? I want to tell you, the most influential factor has been the growing prevalence of divorce in our society. And the attitude that divorce for any cause is perfectly acceptable. God didn't make that law to punish us. God didn't make that law because he didn't know what was best for us. God made that law because he knows the only thing that will really work. Let me follow up on it once again. Think about the application of that. Every marriage has its problems. And a couple in a marriage relationship, the freshness and the excitement of the marriage has worn off. Whether in some cases, I guess it wears off in a couple of weeks. In other cases, it maybe takes a couple of years or something. But the freshness of the marriage has worn off. And the problems that inevitably come begin to surface. Now you take a couple, both of whom are committed to God's law. It never even enters into the mind of either one of them that the solution to this is going to be to get a divorce. Now what are they going to do? They're going to figure out some way to solve that problem. And the other ones that are going to come up after that. Because they've got that common commitment, not just to each other. You know, if the common commitment is just to each other, you know what happens? One of them's always sitting there worried. If she doesn't love me anymore, then it'll all come apart. But if both of them know that it's not just their love for each other, but their common commitment to the Lord as well. I can't imagine anybody loving me for all my life. I mean, I've got enough quirks, and I think probably most of us are that way. If that's all it was going to depend on, me being lovable enough for, you know, I just can't quite imagine that. But I know I can count on somebody to be faithful to the Lord all their life. You got two people that can count on each other, not only in their relationship to each other, but in their common relationship to the Lord. And it doesn't even enter their mind. And not only that, the one looks at the other and says, and I know they're not even thinking about it either. I know they're not even thinking about the possibility of divorce. And so you know what? A couple with that type of foundation, they can solve the problem. They say, okay, we get busy and we'll solve the problem because there's really not any other option open for us. And so they'll solve it, and they'll solve the other problems that come up. Unless one of them not only ceases to be faithful to the other person, but ceases to be faithful to the Lord, and leaves and goes and takes up with somebody else, and is unfaithful to the marriage. In which case, that's the exception. But you take a couple that don't have that foundation. And the one is always afraid that the other one may fall out of love. I mean, you listen to these people show up on TV all the time. You know, well, why'd y'all ever? Well, we just realized we weren't in love anymore. Oh, yeah, that's all there is to it. We just realized we weren't in love anymore. And as soon as I fall in love, I'll get married with somebody else until I fall out of love with them. And you just kind of fall in and fall out of marriage. And if that's the basis people operate on, I don't see how you can have any security in a marriage relationship at all. Because those things come and go. And the whole time you sit there and wonder, is that person going to love me as much now? Are they going to love me more than anyone else that they're ever going to meet for all those years down the future? You live worried about that. And then, if you complicate that further with the realization that the other person feels, and you feel that if things don't work out, well, all we've got to do is go get a divorce. I mean, we got no-fault divorce here. We got it in Florida. We got it in California. A lot of other states, too. Well, it's simple. They even got some fill-it-out-yourself legal forms to do it now. Avoid some of the lawyer's fees in the process. And when it's that simple and that easy, then when you face the problems, what do? What's the incentive to face them? What's the incentive to really deal with the problem? Well, it's not there. So what do? You divorce. Later, marry somebody else. Same problem comes up. May divorce again. The only way people can have the confidence in a marriage relationship that will enable them to truly enjoy it, and to enjoy it without the fear and the worry of what's going to happen to this marriage down the line. What is going to happen if I fall in love with somebody else, or if my spouse falls in love with somebody else? What is going to happen if some problem comes up so big that it just tears us apart? The only thing that will give a marriage the security that it has to have, and that's what the kids need in the marriage, is security. Not just that the parents physically stay together, but they stay together in a secure way so that it does never even enter into the kids' minds that the parents might leave either, is to keep God's law. And when everybody's committed to that and everybody knows that, then that's just like that fence around the backyard for the little kid. Inside that fence, they can enjoy it. Yeah, there'll be problems. Just like the little kid in the backyard, he'll fall and skin his knees still in the backyard. There'll be problems. But they can be overcome, and there won't be problems that will destroy it. And that's why God made the law that way. not to hem us in, not to punish us or to destroy us, but to set us free to enjoy the very relationship that He created to make us happy. When He said, "It is not good for man that he should be alone." God didn't make His laws to restrain us for the sake of punishment, but to set us free. That's what the psalmist had discovered. He says that he'll walk in freedom because he seeks God's precepts. Let me suggest one other factor that's involved here as well, to lay aside now the illustration of marriage. Go back to the point that many people think of law and freedom as contradictory. In the letter of 2 Peter, 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 17 through 19. Second Peter chapter 2, verses 17 through 19. The Apostle Peter here speaks of certain false teachers, and he said, "They're springs without water, mist driven by a storm for whom the black darkness has been reserved. So speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error." And then notice especially what he says in verse 19. He says, "Promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption." Now, the point I'd like to draw out of that is, whenever somebody entices you to step away from God's laws, saying you can be free from that, look beyond the enticement to freedom and say, okay, free from that and a slave to what else? Because there is no such thing as absolute freedom. There is simply no such thing as absolute freedom. If you're freed from one thing, it's only because you've submitted to something else. Give you almost trivial and yet I think relevant illustration. I grew up in the 60s, early 70s. Some of the rest of you did too. That was a period of time in which so many of the laws, including so much of our marriage law, since the children ought to be subject to the laws laid down by their parents, so much of that deteriorated. And it was an era in which everybody was promising freedom. And so you became a hippie and you were free. You were free from your parents and you were free from the laws at school and you were free from the laws of the government. And if the law said don't smoke marijuana, you smoked marijuana to prove that you could. You know, it's funny. Did you ever notice, some of y'all didn't grow up then, if you've seen on the films and so forth, all the young people, the youth movement, the hippies that were all set free, did you ever notice the uniform they wore? They all wore the same thing. They all had those long, guys had these bell-bottom pants, and they had this kind of a tight, flowery print shirt, you know, and they had the hair that was long, came down about right here, and they always had one of those leather medallions right around their chest with the little yippies. They were free, weren't they? Somehow, those free people all had to wear exactly the same thing. And I want to tell you, if you walked into a group of them and you were dressed like I was, you see how free you were. They weren't free. They just exchanged one freedom for another. They had rules they had to follow. They had things they had to submit to fit into their group. And you'll find it's always that way. No such thing as absolute freedom. It's a matter of choice. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve somebody who is going to provide you laws for your destruction and for their benefit? Or are you going to serve somebody who's given you laws to set you free and for your benefit? The world has all sorts of laws that are for the benefit of the people in the world that make those laws. God has laws for you that He made for your benefit, to set you free from sin and the things about sin that would destroy you, and prepare you to enjoy the life that God created you for, and ultimately to enjoy eternity with Him in heaven. Which will it be? Which set of laws Which lawgiver are you going to take? Maybe that there's someone here this morning who has been serving sin, serving Satan, needs to come and serve under what James refers to as the law of liberty, law of Christ that sets us free from sin and death. If you're subject to the invitation, need to confess your faith, repent of your sins, and be baptized, we invite you to come while we stand and sing the selected song.